Sidebar with author of the Hillbilly Elegy, J.D. Vance.
Okay, and we're going to give everyone some time to trickle in because that very reason. Notifications are slow these days on YouTube. Come on, here. What's going on here? Oh, no. Don't give me problems again. Viva, we need some good news. Love you guys. The good news tonight is going to be JD's story. It's going to be the man behind the story. And it's just, it's not a feel-good story, but it has a very good ending. Although the ending is the present, which is interesting. We'll see what the future holds. Okay. Who says no volume? I am gullible. Don't do it. I think the audio is good. What else? That's it. No legal advice. Yada, yada, yada. And the movie was great. I haven't seen the movie, but what a notch in the belt to have written a book that became a bestseller and then have a Netflix series made on it. Okay, without further ado, I think we're good here. About 4 or 5 minutes in, we got JD and we've got Robert in the backstage. I shall bring Robert in first just because I know what's going to happen when I do this. Then JD. And now I reposition. Wrong way. There we go. Everyone's audio is good?
Good.
Absolutely.
Okay. And if anyone in the chat, let me know if one of us is massively overblown or underblown. All right, JD, first of all, Robert, nice to see you again, as always. JD, thank you for doing this. And it's going to be amazing. We've never met before. We met for 2 minutes before we went live. And I saved my questions for when we go live. Where do we start? We're going to start with, give everyone an intro as to who you are before we start diving into the book, the past, the present, and the future.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure where exactly you want me to start, but I guess the brief summary is I grew up in a working class family in southwestern Ohio. My family had pretty deep ties to southeastern Kentucky coal country, which is pretty common for folks in this part of the world. I went off to the Marine Corps, went to college, went to law school, got out of the legal world and got into the sort of the business world. And I've been working in that for pretty much, my entire sort of post-law school career. And I also, other than writing the book, I also, pop off on politics from time to time. So that's kind of my story. And, I think because of, I don't know, I guess because the book maybe had mainstream appeal, or because, I've tried not to be super, super political with the exception of the last few years. People are like sometimes very surprised or at least very put off by the fact that I can be out there on politics sometimes. So if you've heard of me the past few years, it's probably because I've said something on TV or on Twitter that really pissed a lot of people off, which, that's fine. That's the world we live in.
Okay. So I guess the first question is, we're going to get into it. You wrote the book called The Hillbilly Elegy. I had to look up what elegy meant because I didn't know what the word meant until I heard the book. And it means something of, it's not a eulogy, but it's something like that where you're symbolizing the end of something. And you document your life, born to a mother who suffered from addiction throughout your life. You're bouncing around father figures as your mother dates additional men. You're raised by your grandparents. You write a book called The Hillbilly Elegy, which documents this part of America. And you preface the book by having to address certain, the racial aspect of things that are going on in the United States now. Did you get flack, or did you get pushback rather, for being in the era of white privilege, for being someone who's white, complaining or criticizing or talking about how harsh and how hard your upbringing was, despite the fact that you are a white person in America?
Yeah, definitely. And there's, one of the tones in the book is that I try not to complain too much because I think like a lot of us who grew up in this part of the world, it's sort of considered untoward or, just a little babyish to complain about your life and pretend that it was hard. But, like objectively, I definitely had an underprivileged and scare quotes upbringing. And I do think that some of the negative response to the book is that we're in this weird cultural moment where we want to say that everyone who belongs to some racial groups is privileged and everybody who belongs to other racial groups is underprivileged. And there is a way in which my story just goes against the grain of that. And also a way in which I think that we're so uncomfortable in this country talking about, disadvantage as anything other than a racial signifier, right? So I believe, and I think if you read the book, you probably get this, that the biggest advantage you can have as a young kid in America these days is to grow up in a two-parent family with a relatively healthy community around you. Now, that is true whether you're Black or white. And because I just don't think that these things are hyper-racialized, I think it's really about the individual circumstances of each family's life. Some people don't like that. But, you know, I think at a fundamental level, they're just wrong. So I don't worry too much about it.
Now, you mentioned in the book the kind of cultural shock of going from, and this is sort of skipping ahead in the story a little bit, but it was one of the parts that stood out to me because I share that in common with you, which is, you know, going from Appalachia and including, you know, Ohio State and the Marines, but that you really didn't fully appreciate the culture shock until you went to Yale. Could you describe what some of that was like? In other words, how it was surprising, the degree to which that, you know, as Jesse Jackson used to say, Yale isn't the best and the brightest. It's often the richest and the whitest. You know, you can play around with the verbiology, but it's very much a culture yep. that is disconnected from places like Middletown, Ohio. What was that like for you? And was it right away? I mean, for me, it was within a couple of weeks of being on campus.
Yeah. No, that's right. And yeah, I know, Robert, you have your own interesting stories with this part of the world. Would love to chat about that. I mean, you know, for me, the way that I put it is, you know, the Marine Corps was in some ways a totally different world for me, right? I mean, it was hyper disciplined. Obviously, you know, the life of the military is just much different for, you know, 99% of American kids from what they've seen growing up. But I was still fundamentally surrounded by people who were like me. You know, I had this like great friend who was a Puerto Rican kid from the Bronx. I had another great friend who grew up in sort of, you know, pretty upper middle class suburb of D.C. But like they were all like me in a fundamental level. You know, they sort of had the same basic views. They were all pretty patriotic. They all had the same concerns more or less about the world. I never felt like, you know, they weren't on the same team as me. Whereas when you go to Yale and you come from a background like mine, it's just like, holy crap, this entire universe is different. Right. And you know, some of it is just little social things that I never realized, right? So I tell this story in the book that I go to this law firm recruitment dinner. It's this really high-pressure moment where you're trying to get a job. And, you know, they gather us into this room beforehand, and they bring around glasses of wine. They're like, you know, do you want white wine or red wine? And I'm like, you know, I'll take some white wine. And then it's like, do you want Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc? And it's like, you know, this person's clearly screwing with me. Just give me some white wine. Stop with these ridiculous questions. So there's like a social way of conducting yourself that was totally foreign to me. But then a part of it is also like the elite world is so transactional. I'm curious, you know, your guys' views on this. But what really bothered me about it is that every relationship seemed geared towards getting something for yourself, right? Like you didn't hang out with people because they were interesting or, you know, maybe you were attracted to them or whatever the case may be. It's like you hung out with people because you thought they could bring some benefit to you, that they could make an introduction to somebody, that they could write you a letter of recommendation, that there could be some sort of 2 or 3 degrees of separation between you and a job that you wanted. And I just thought that was so gross, right? Like where I grew up, you built relationships with people who had the same interests with you, or at least were interesting to you. You didn't build relationships with people just because you could get something out of them. And that was the part of it that I felt was weirdest.
Well, I mean, I've had similar experiences in the practice of law. But you find it everywhere, is that there are people who view these relationships. When you talk about the network capital in your book, the value of having a network, people see that as some people see it as purely transactional. Others see it as an emotional sort of friendship network. And I get the feeling that people can see through it and get irritated by it or know when someone is motivated by that. But yes, I mean, I found when you're working your way up the ladder world, it is all a question of politics, whether it's politics politically or politics in the corporate law structure.
Well, and in that context, and I guess this will sort of take us back to the beginning, if you will, that, you know, so much of the safe space culture, as well as networking culture that you describe, I mean, these kids are learning from the time they're little. You know, in terms of what schools they go to, that your friends are about self-advancement, that, you know, it's whenever you meet somebody, it's not how are you? You know, it's what can you do for me? You know, Hollywood was the worst at this in L.A. I mean, the conversation would last 30 seconds if they couldn't find a transactional angle in talking to you for any longer. But it going like growing up in Middletown, in terms of one of the virtues of that lifestyle, of that community, despite the problems you document in detail at Hillbilly Elegy, aside from sort of the virtue of loyalty, which I think is critically essential and fundamental and underappreciated in the Yale elite world, But the other is, you know, I assume when you were growing up, how much is this that you could just, if you were playing as a kid, there wasn't like safe space play date culture. It was you go out and you play with your friends, you meet up with your friends. How much was that part of your growing up, which is separate from how many of the kids these days who grew up in a very controlled, particularly upper middle class controlled culture?
And hold on, JD, before you answer, apparently your volume is low. So can you bring your mic closer?
Yeah.
Or talk louder.
let me just talk louder. Let me try to talk louder, and we can see how that works, and then we can go from there. So, folks, if you still can't hear me, let us know, because then I can just I actually have some headphones downstairs, so I can try to run and grab them. I think it was Thomas Sowell, Robert, who wrote this really interesting. Maybe it was an essay or maybe it was a part of one of his books, that one of the biggest differences between like working class kids and upper middle class or privileged kids is there's a totally different way that they play, right? And you know, like when I was a kid with my friends, you know, it was always a little bit violent, not like violent, like you're going to get the crap kicked out of you, you're going to go home with like bruises, but just like we were always roughhousing a little bit. We were always giving each other a hard time. There was definitely a real pride placed on being able to sort of stand up, be a little tough, being willing to take the emotional, you know, the emotional slings and arrows, you know, sticks and stones break my bones, but words can never hurt me. And I thought about this a lot in the context of Yale because, you know, I remember when I was in a seminar my third year of law school, and there's this girl who's actually a very sweet person, very progressive. I haven't talked to her in years, but we were talking about something of a national security related matter, and it came up that I had served 4 years in the Marine Corps. And she was so shocked, and she turned around and looked at me and said, "I can't believe you were in the military." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Well, you're just so nice, right?" And so the implication here is that, like, if you're in the military, you must have been some marauding barbarian just walking around and killing people. And I remember my reaction to it was like, "Huh, that's kind of weird," but I didn't really let it get to me. And somebody later on told me during an interview that, you know, if that had happened to almost any other demographic in America, we would have called it a microaggression, right? This is sort of a classic microaggression. And, you know, on the one hand, I thought to myself, yeah, that's kind of right. But on the other hand, I'm actually glad that I grew up in a working class background where my response was, you know, that was sort of an off color comment, but I'm not going to take huge offense to it. And I think it makes for just building better relationships. And I'm sure you guys have seen this in your own life. But when you're not worried about offending somebody, it's much easier to build an actual relationship with them. Right. That's what was so cool about the military. Is we said ridiculous, offensive things to each other that you like, if any of us was public, would ruin all of our lives in the age of social media. But we like made fun of where we were from, and people called me a hillbilly, a redneck, a toothless, this and that. And it's like my response to that was, yeah, I'm going to give it back as good as I get it. Not I'm going to run and whine about it because it's the end of the world. And I do think we've missed that virtue in a lot of our upper crust society, which is where a lot of the PC stuff, it's where a lot of the cancel culture comes from, is like these kids are just super thin skinned.
I just want to go back to one thing you mentioned, Thomas Sowell. Listening to your book, it was as though I was listening to one particular story from Sowell's book, Black Redneck White Liberals. Is that Sowell's book? He says, you know, it's not so much a racial thing, but a poverty thing and a family thing, and then whether or not there's racial historical explanations for why there's disparities in those. When you're talking about your history, and when people talk about white privilege, and then they just assume that it's better to be poor and white than poor and black, where you know your story illustrates that being poor, coming from places where there's no economy, where there's no jobs, broken homes, white or black, that's going to leave an impact, and it's going to give you a something of a disadvantage from the get-go. And when I was reading some of the reviews, it seems that people think that you're taking a racial side to this, making excuses for why it's the case for some white communities. I don't necessarily agree with that, the distinction, but what you're illustrating in your book is these things are fundamental disadvantages regardless of race. And they have the same impact regardless of race. And it reminded me very much of what Sowell said. And for everybody who doesn't know, watching the stream now, didn't read your book, you're raised by your grandparents. Your mother struggles with addiction for your entire life up to the present, from what I understand. At one point, this was my point, the poignant part of the book, where she gets you in a car, basically, and starts speeding and says she's going to kill you by crashing the car, then pulls over to hit you, and you run off into a stranger's house in the middle of a cornfield. Your mother finds you, pulls you out of the house, and then your granddad, when the day is over, puts his hand on you and sobs because, you know, this is the life that you're living. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't gotten to the part of the book where you said, you know, he felt as though he let your mother down, but that's, I knew where it was going, is that everybody's sort of letting everyone down in terms of how they were supposed to be brought up. It's a long-winded question. How do you get over those scars? Do you get over those scars? And I sort of know the answer because I got to the end of the book, but everyone out there, like, how do you not succumb to that type of upbringing and just give up, so to speak, psychologically, spiritually, emotionally?
Yeah, it's such a complicated question and such a complicated answer, but I'll try to do the best that I can. I mean, you know, one, I'll say for those who have read the book and identified with the characters, I will say, you know, mom has been clean now for 6 years, which is just crazy. It's such an incredible blessing for her to come over, you know, a couple nights a week and have dinner with our kids. I really thought when I read the book, she would be dead. I mean, I was just certain that she would not be alive when the book came out. And that was not true. Thank God that things have taken a positive direction or have gone in a positive direction for her. You know, I think there are a couple of things that were really critical to me making it. One is it really was my grandparents providing stability. I think there's a lot of research to this effect. But I've even talked to child psychologists who say, you know, one of the most common things that you see, maybe the most common thing you see in what they call resilient children, i.e. kids who come from traumatic backgrounds but have decent lives anyway, is they had one person that they could rely on, whether it's a teacher, a grandparent, an aunt or an uncle. And of course, that for me, that was my grandparents. And, you know, if I can provide some psychological, you know, if that's the quantitative fact, some qualitative insight into that. You know, it was definitely just nice to know that I always would have a place to stay, that I always would have people to rely on. But, you know, what it did for me is that, right, I think so many kids who come from tough circumstances, you know, the world keeps on kicking them down. They get resentful about it. They don't like the people around them. They feel, you know, not totally unfairly, like the world has been just really hard for them. You know, but because I had my grandparents and because, you know, I remember my grandma like sharing her Meals on Wheels food with me when times were really tight with us, you know, that just gives you a sense of duty, right? And that can be actually enriching and empowering in a certain way, is like, you know what, things haven't been totally easy for me, but there are all of these people who have worked very hard on my behalf, and I owe it to them to at least try at something, to at least give myself a decent chance. In that sense that if Mamaw died, knowing that I was a kid who was in jail or addicted to drugs or something, that was really motivating and really powerful to me. And I think that's what's going on with a lot of these kids, right? I've talked to a lot of kids about this. And, you know, having that person you can rely on is really powerful. I saw, you know, one of the commenters who said the kids who were raised by their grandparents in school were angry as hell. I was definitely an angry kid in school. But I think it's one thing to be an angry kid. It's another thing to just totally give up on yourself. And because I had my grandparents, I always sort of had that sense of obligation to them. And that was very helpful to me.
Yeah. One of the stories you tell, I'm not sure if it's in the book, but I saw it separately, was when Mamaw helped discipline you from getting around and associated with the wrong crowd. It's a story that, you know, I could relate to on many levels. But that sometimes, you know, a dramatic method of introducing that to a kid can be effective. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, Robert, sorry. For some reason, you broke up for just a second there. The first part.
Sure. So it's the story about your mama helping you stay away from the wrong kids.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I think Mamaw understood, this is the word that I had for my grandma, pretty common in Appalachian, you know, subculture. You know, Mamaw recognized that a lot of these community influences were very social, right? That what worked for some kids, it wasn't just the lessons that you were taught. It wasn't just, you know, what sort of, you know, financial opportunities that you had. It was like, what are the people around you showing you is possible and impossible? What expectations are they setting? And Mamaw, you know, knew that I would start to hang around with some of the kids in the neighborhood who were doing drugs, who were dealing drugs. And this was, you know, we were 12 years old or so at the time. You know, this wasn't like, you know, high level cartel trading, but, you know, just kids who were starting to deal a little bit of weed and do, you know, smoke weed. And Mamaw found out that I was hanging out with this kid. And she said, look, JD, if you don't stop hanging out with this kid, I'm going to run him over with my car. And, you know, no one is ever going to find out about it. And she was such a tough old bird that I was like, is she really going to kill this kid? Well, maybe, actually. And if it's maybe, then I should probably stop hanging out with this kid. And so, you know, I got some friends who were on the straight and narrow, who were like involved in church and things like that. And that was definitely, again, one of these critical, these sort of critical moments where I think my life got started on the right trajectory. You know, Mamaw was such a unique figure. She doesn't meet the stereotype I think a lot of people have of grandmas. You know, she wasn't like sitting at home knitting me sweaters. You know, she was one of these women who had like over a dozen handguns when she died. And you know, she was so unable to get around. She was, you know, so handicapped by the end of her life, but she always wanted to have access to a gun. So when she died, we found like loaded firearms all over her house, right? The thinking being like, okay, well, she can't get around with a walker, but if somebody busts into her house, she's going to have one within arm's reach no matter where. And I mean, some of these guns, like she gave me, you know, one thing she had to give me, and I, you know, I have it one room over in my house right now, is a 44 Magnum that she just loved. She loved Clint Eastwood and Dirty Harry, and you know, she just loved that it was, she always told me, the most powerful handgun ever made. I mean, towards the end of her life, Mamaw could not even hold that gun, much less fire. I mean, I don't know if you guys are firearms people, but like a 44 Magnum is packs some punch. You know what I mean? And I still to this day can't imagine what she was doing with that gun, because even when she was pretty healthy, she probably couldn't have fired it. Anyway, I guess the point is, to bring it back to your original question, Robert, is that she was incredibly disciplined and unconventional. But I think for a kid who grew up in a really tough circumstance, that was just really important and valuable.
Like I say, that is the idea of my grandmother ever holding a gun, let alone owning multiple guns in various rooms. I mean, my grandmother, I don't think I ever heard her swear.
Yeah. And you know, I think about this, especially these sort of debates about gun rights that are, you know, happening these days, is like, I think the stereotype that a lot of people have of people like my grandmother is that they're just crazy gun nuts. And it's, you know, a small miracle that people like me, you know, managed to live in our house for so many years without shooting ourselves or shooting a friend accidentally. And I actually remember, I didn't tell this story in the book. I don't think it's one weird thing about writing a book about your life is you start to forget what things are in and out. But, you know, the first time that she ever let me shoot a pistol, you know, she's taught me like the three critical rules of safety. Keep your fingers straight and off the trigger until you're ready to fire. Never point the barrel in anything you don't want to kill. Always keep the safety on until you're ready to shoot. But of all that stuff. And she brought, I didn't even notice at the time, but she like brought like a watermelon and she set it on the ground. And I was like listening to these rules. I was like 7 years old. And, she sort of realized that I was slacking off a little bit. So she just very gently pointed the gun at the watermelon and fired it. It was like, you scared the hell out of me, right? It was a very loud gun. And then she pointed at the watermelon and said, pay attention. If you don't pay attention and you do something stupid with a gun, that's what your face is going to look like. And I just never had any like lack of respect for a weapon after that. And that I think is sort of a much more common story, maybe not that extreme. But, you know, it just reminds me that in sort of, you know, cultures where guns actually matter, people tend to take them pretty seriously. They're not just sort of, you know, willy-nilly playing with them like toys.
Well, very much that one of the great misunderstandings in the gun control debate by the left is the idea that the only reason you'd use a gun is if, you know, you're an old royal family doing fox hunting in Britain. You know, or you're a crazy person. You're one or the other. But that guns are not only part of identity, that it helps people feel safe more than anything else. It helps them feel secure in a world where that is a functional reality they have to deal with. And I think that lack of life experience is what informs so much of the misshaped gun control debate on the left. And I think that's a classic story and a version of it. To what degree, what's the other thing that you were talking about with the Marines was the democratization that takes place within the Marines, that so many people come from working class backgrounds, mm-hmm. so, and that no matter whether geographic location, no matter whether racial identity, that none of those things matter anywhere as much as their shared cultural and economic background that leads them to easily get along with one another in the Marines. Was that your experience in the Marines?
It definitely was. And, you know, I was enlisted, and I do wonder, you know, I mean, I'm such an old man at this point, or I'm getting up there, that, you know, I left the Marine Corps 14 years ago. And I hope that things haven't changed, though I certainly worry that maybe at the officer corps, things are a little bit different than they were when I was in the Marines. But to actually answer your question, I mean, what was so cool about the Marines is it was like a genuinely colorblind society, right? It was like totally unacceptable to think about anybody as anything but a fellow Marine. And our drill instructors always said, you know, there's light green Marines and dark green Marines, but that's it. That's as far as that goes. And two is like, it actually kind of worked, right? I mean, we all came from different cultures. We all came from different backgrounds and environments, but we all felt like we were on the same team. That was sort of the third thing that I really took away from this is, you know, it's pretty powerful to be in a group of young men and feel like you're oriented towards a common objective and a common goal. And that's what the Marine Corps really gave to us. It's like, look, you come from different places, you all have different aptitudes, but like, we're going to do this thing. We're going to do it together. You're not going to leave anybody behind. You know, if you screw up and mess something up, we're going to force you to try again, even if you don't want to. And it just creates this incredible sense of like willfulness, right? It's the opposite of helplessness. It's the sense that we can accomplish things together. And, you know, it's the institution in our society that I still think to this day works incredibly well at taking people from our incredibly rich and varied country and actually combining them into a common unit, a common purpose. I unfortunately think that so many of our leaders have not taken to heart the lessons about what it means to really be part of the same team when they try to divide us and pit us against each other. Because, you know, if you're going to have a country, if you're going to have a community, if you're going to have a group of people who are accomplishing the same things, whether it's a Marine Corps unit or a whole nation, you know, you actually have to feel some sense of common purpose. You can't constantly talk about and focus about all the things that are different, all the disagreements that you have, all of the things that one group has, where they could be angry at another group. It just doesn't work. You can't build a society like that.
You know, reading the book, actually, or listening to the book, it seemed to me that the saving element of your life, or at least where the trajectory was totally turned, was when you went into the Marines, where you basically learned discipline on the one hand, but also you learned not to underestimate your own capabilities. Mm-hmm. And for that, your life might have had a totally different trajectory. And it kind of made me envious and made me regret having not done that or anything like that in my life, because I've never done anything like that in my life. And then you had the interesting anecdote when you're in Yale. Was it Yale or was it in Ohio U where someone is talking about the war in Iraq?
You know, that was the guy, Ohio State. Yeah.
Ohio State. Ohio State. Somebody, you know, what they call the neckbeards, or someone who's never spent a day in his life doing anything of that nature, judging the quality of the spirit of the soldier. How much of that did you get going through life, and how do you not get frustrated at that? You know, the level of ignorance of someone who's never served a day judging those who have sacrificed more than they can ever imagine, so that he can literally sit there and judge those who have made the sacrifice.
Yeah, you know, it was my first introduction to what might be called, you know, sort of elite condescension of the rest of the country. And, you know, the fact that this guy just had no real sense of what service meant. He had no real sense of the people who were trying to accomplish the mission. And, you know, like, I'm not going to sit here and tell you, especially with the benefit of hindsight, that the Iraq War was great military strategy or even a worthwhile military adventure. But the people who were involved in it were trying, and in very, almost nearly every case, were conducting themselves with incredible honor and commitment. In fact, I mean, we were saddled by rules of engagement and things that even if the mission was accomplishable, it made it even that much harder, because we were frankly, you know, fighting in a totally different way than a lot of folks in a lot of different, a lot of different environments. And that was a pretty common complaint from people, is, you know, you sort of talk to people who had just been out on a mission and, it's like, you know, my God, the things we're not allowed to do out there, pretty crazy given how violent and destructive it was. And I was very lucky, you know, I mean, we had a couple of sort of incidents where I was, you know, some mortar fire, some things like that, but I largely avoided any real combat. And, you know, the people who were really fighting day to day, it's like, you know, my God, it's amazing how handicapped we were out there. Anyway, the elite condescension was really, really powerful and really, really gross. And again, I wouldn't have described it like this at the time, but what it made me realize is that you have an entire group of people, primarily working and middle-class Americans, who are enlisting in our military, who are fighting our wars. And then you have a group of people who are primarily from the upper middle class or above, who have so little day-to-day connection with the military. And there are obviously a lot of good things about an all-volunteer military force, but one of the things it's done is create this incredible divide between people who have served and their families and people who haven't. And, I think that's a real problem. It's, you know, I saw it in that way at Ohio State, but it's a much bigger problem for other reasons in other spheres.
Well, one thing that's fascinating is the part of the country you're from, both in terms of sort of both Appalachia, what used to be Jacksonian America, to use Sean Trendy's phrase, that, you know, extended all the way up, you know, it was almost a reverse L from eastern Oklahoma all the way to western North Carolina up to Pennsylvania, including West Virginia and southeastern Ohio and the rest of part of it. There's two things that are notable about them as it relates to war, which is first, they're the number one volunteer group over American history for all kinds of wars and military conflicts in the sense of defending their country, defending their fellow man. At the same time, politically, they're one of the most anti-war groups historically, mm-hmm. especially as you get into the hardcore mountains,
yep.
Where, you know, you're not far from where your grandma was from. So the in that sense, and it's because of a recognition of how foolish these wars often are. They're politicians' wars, you know, to quote CCR about, you know, no senator's son's going off to die.
Yep.
The in that sense, and you got to sort of experience both sides of that because you go into the Marines, you know, during the patriotic peak of we're defending America, doing liberty, doing democracy, get to witness the kind of debacle that takes place, both from a military and political perspective, come back. And I think people have still underappreciated, definitely some of the Mona Sharens and whatever other world, that was a turning event for a lot of what I would call the populist working class,
yep.
Right, even some independent and left, where, as well as the media, which we'll get to later, in the sense that the disaster of that war led them to be deeply skeptical of these ceaseless, endless wars and neoconservatism in general. How much was that your own personal experience and what you went through?
That maps my personal experience very well. I write in the book that my grandma was so mad when I enlisted. I mean, she was just, I've never seen her just with such a combination of anger and frustration and sadness as when I told her that I enlisted. And there was definitely, you know, she was a very patriotic woman, but there was definitely a component of that CCR anti-war populism. It's like, why do you have to go off and do this? You know, it's not our families that are deciding to do this crap. Let the rich people's kids go off and fight these wars if they want to go and do this. And so that was definitely a real part of it. But, you know, at the same time, she was just so proud, right? And that those two instincts and those two feelings exist within her in incredible tension. And, you know, that's just how it was among a lot of those families. I mean, you know, we lived on the 300 McKinley block of Middletown, Ohio. And in my year, 2003, there were two kids who graduated from high school on that block. Me and this kid named Nicholas, both of us enlisted in the Marine. We were both in the same boot camp platoon, which is actually, my understanding, is pretty unusual in Parris Island, South Carolina. Like, the sense of service and obligation was so powerful. And, you know, Mamaw had six. I just saw one of the comments talk about the family tradition of service. Mamaw had six grandkids, three of them enlisted in the Marine Corps right out of high school. And that's you know, that's just how it was. But no, she was so, so mad about the war. There was a part of me that, you know, to be a little sentimental or self-reflective or self-critical, that, you know, wondered when she was in ill health towards the end of her life and she died about 2 or 3 months before I left for Iraq. Like, there was definitely a part of me in the back of my mind that, like, did this kill Mamaw, right? Because she was so upset about it. She was so sick with grief. And she was already pretty frail. And, you know, you sort of recognize those concerns are, you know, a little overblown as you grow and mature. But it really bothered me, and I really never quite got Mamaw to appreciate that this was something meaningful to me, even though she was very proud of my service. You know, it's kind of crazy. You guys may remember this book. I think it came out in 2005, 2004. I read it when I was in Iraq. It's called The Case for Democracy by Natan Sharansky. And it was very influential in sort of these like pro-democracy, let's invade countries and convert them to our way of life, way of thinking. And I was like a patriotic young kid, and that was like the zeitgeist, right? So I read this book and I was like, oh yeah, you know, this is what we're going to go and do. And I remember, you know, one of the things I got assigned to do when I was over there is do security for the camp where the poll workers were being held. This was in October of 2005. You remember the pink fingers all over the TV that the Iraqis were voting on a constitutional referendum. And then in December 2005, I think they had their first parliamentary elections. And I remember doing sort of security for these poll workers, and you're like living in their camp and you're going around and doing things, making sure, you know, people aren't smuggling contraband, making sure that like nobody comes up to you and says, hey, you know, this person's like a terrorist, get him out of this camp. And I loved the people. Right? I mean, they were so cool. They were funny. They were curious in what we were doing. There were definitely some weirdos there, but as like a, you know, group of people, I kind of liked them. But it was pretty clear they were just a totally different culture than the United States. Like the idea that they were just going to convert to U.S. style democracy with, you know, a few thousand rounds of ammunition was just ridiculous, right? It was obvious to all of us that this is like a totally different world. And if they're ever going to be truly democratic, it's going to take a long, 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 long time. And that was a pretty, you know, influential moment in my own political development when I got there and realized that book, it was compelling as I found it in the abstract, didn't really work in practice.
JD, did, when your grandmother was so upset that you joined the military, was it because, do you think it was because she deep down knew that it might mean the end of you living, I forget where you were in Ohio at that time, but that you wouldn't be coming home?
Oh, yeah. No, that's definitely right. I mean, she wanted me to go, you know, she wanted me to go to school at the local community college or maybe at Ohio State. Those, you know, those were basically the places that I applied out of high school. And just be close to home, get an education. You know, her sort of view, you know, she said this to me all the time, is kind of like, you're the family's last hope. You're going to go and be a, you know, professional. You're going to make money. You're going to take care of everybody. That was sort of her ambition for me. And yeah, she definitely wanted me to be close to home. And I think was definitely upset that I wasn't. And, you know, I was one of these kids, whenever I got leave, you know, whenever we got what we called a 72 or a 96, a 3 or 4 day weekend, like I would just buy a plane ticket home, right? I just wanted to see my mamaw and be around my sister and her babies as much as possible. But you know, that was definitely something that bothered her, is just the separation. And, you know, I think she also knew that it would likely mean a deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan. She didn't want that either.
How much was it revelatory that what you experienced was completely contrary, not only to what the public intellectuals were pushing, particularly within the neocon world, but also what the press pushed? In other words, that all of these stories, Saddam Hussein is weapons of mass destruction, you have to go there to free the world, the Iraqis can't wait to have American-style democracy, you know, all of these mythologies that were used as the pretext for war, and then you get there on the ground and you experience they're all lies. How much does it impact how you perceive those institutions and those public intellectuals thereafter?
You know, I think it affected me, but not right away, right? There was still there are one of, I think, three ways to look at American elites, the American ruling class over the past 20 or 30 years. And, you know, one way is that they're basically right, right? Everything's going great. It's really working. I think it's hard to believe that these days, but that's one attitude, right? The ruling class really knows what it's doing. Attitude two is that the ruling class is really incompetent. And attitude three is that the ruling class is actually malicious and evil. And I think that like what started to happen when I was in Iraq was I started to move from the ruling class knows what it's doing. We live in the greatest country in the world. Our leaders have they have their eye on the prize, to started thinking that like these people are actually pretty incompetent, right? That these people who we expect to exercise power over lives in this sort of, you know, very positive and, you know, very, very smart way, they're actually maybe not as smart as I thought that they were. And then I think the point where eventually I got to, which it really took me a long time from there, is like, actually, maybe these people are just really bad people, right? And maybe they're incompetent too, but they're not actually even that well-intentioned. And that took me a long time to get from where I was in 2006 to where I am now. It probably took me 10 years.
That was one thing. I mean, I was reading the book. I didn't know what your political leanings were. They seemed to be on both sides, depending on the time. You consider yourself to be conservative at this point, or are you somewhat candidate oriented or specifically conservative?
No, I think I've always been conservative, but it's always been a little bit weird for me because, you know, growing up in kind of a working class Democratic household, you know, my conservatism has tended to be more on like cultural, I mean, for lack of a better word, more on cultural issues and less on economic issues, right? So like, you know, my grandparents never really cared about like, you know, early 1990s Republican Party orthodoxy on economics, right? That was like not, in fact, if they cared at all, it's probably in the opposite direction. That was never really my thing. My thing was always like, you know, this is the greatest country in the world. We owe something to it. It's given us a lot. You know, certainly on a lot of these like weird racial issues that have taken on an increasingly like, you know, if you're white, you're fundamentally privileged, you're bad, whatever the case may be, like definitely had, you know, the rights of view on that. I mean, it's interesting actually, you know, didn't realize it at the time how compelling or how, you know, influential this would be in my general politics. Is like, if I was generally, let's say from, you know, the time I was in middle school to the time of now, like generally on the right, you know, I cared much more about like pro-life issues and culturally patriotic issues than I did about the economic issues that are popular, you know, for Republican establishment types. I read this book when I was maybe 15 years old called The Death of the West by Patrick Buchanan. And that was a really influential book for me, right? And there are like times in my life where I've said, you know, I sort of, you know, disagreed with Pat Buchanan or more agreed with Pat Buchanan, and certainly more on the agreed with Pat Buchanan on a lot of these things these days. But that was a pretty influential book to me. And in a lot of ways, you know, that book was, I want to say it was published in the early 90s, was pretty good and smart about where American politics would go over the next 20 to 30 years. Like, that was the first time that I heard somebody say, you know, maybe all of these trade deals are not a good idea, right? The consensus, even in 2005, they were like a great idea. So there were a lot of things like that. But yeah, generally been on the right, but I think, you know, more in the last like 5 to 10 years have actually developed a more discrete political philosophy that I feel like is my own, a little bit more solid and not just kind of culturally more aligned with the right than I am with the left, which is where I think, you know, a lot of young people are, you know, whether it's the left or the right, it's more of like cultural instinct than it is sort of a developed political philosophy.
Well, what's amazing is I think so many of the institutional players in the on the right particularly, but really both parties to a large degree, are disconnected from why they won votes in the past. That, you know, you look at someone like Kevin Phillips, who for years was explaining, for decades was explaining this, and he was explaining it about cultural issues, economic issues, social issues. He understood the role between ancestry and religion and geography and political beliefs. And yet this is mostly like, if I was in the political consulting business or the polling business or anything like that, I would be reading Kevin Phillips. And yet most of these people are utterly unfamiliar with him, don't understand the terrain. You know, if you understood, you know, the whole Copperhead history of Southern mm-hmm. Ohio is just one illustration. They have no idea what that, Nate Silver has no idea what that is.
Right.
You know, he's busy trying to figure out why his last poll was wrong or last polling analysis was wrong. But in that context, a lot of sort of the real voting power is sort of a working class populist power that has yep. shifted politically, historically, and where you're from ancestrally is really goes all the way back, was Democrat back to, you know, Andrew Jackson, 1828. And their shift away from the Democratic Party mm-hmm. is what has hurt it to where it's barely gimping by now. And it's what it basically gave the Republican Party its base. But it seems like the political class and the press class within the right never came to terms with this, never yeah. understood what that meant, that these are not country club Republicans. These are people who have different views on trade, different views on economic policy, different ways the government can be proactive in certain areas, certain spaces, whether that's dealing with the opioid epidemic or whether that's dealing with lack of healthcare access or having meaningful educational programs that aren't just four-year driven, not just college certificate driven. Yep. Can you describe some, like, that seems like your progression might seem unusual to outsiders, but seems very natural to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's, you know, like Trump is like a big, big part of this. Right. And just to be like clear, so your audience knows, you know, I'm like, my view on Trump was like, I was not a Trump guy in 2016, more for his personality than his issues. And I really came around by 2020. And so like, I'm not like coming to this as sort of like, I've been on the Trump train the entire time, but like, I think he's like a critical piece of understanding this, right? So the most interesting data set that I've seen on this that just hasn't gotten nearly as much airplay is, I think this guy, what's his name? He's a DC political pollster. He's very smart. Patrick something. Anyway, it'll come to me later. He did an analysis of the Iowa caucus results in 2016. You know, the one where Trump, it looked like he was going to win, but then Ted Cruz came from behind. It was like more or less a tie, if I vaguely recall this. And what he found is that the way in which the polls were most wrong is when they missed how powerful people who identified as Scots-Irish ethnically were supportive of Donald Trump. And there's this political scientist at UT Austin. His name is Mike Lind. I don't know if you guys are familiar at all with Michael Lind. I think he's a brilliant, brilliant guy. You know, but Mike once told me that American history is it's a constant war between Northern Yankees and Southern Bourbons, where whichever side the hillbillies are on wins, right? And that's kind of how I think about, you know, American politics today. Is like the Northern Yankees are now the hyper woke sort of coastal elites. The Southern Bourbons are sort of the, you know, the same old school Southern folks that have been around and influential in this country for 200 years. And it's like the hillbillies have really started to migrate towards the Southern Bourbons instead of the Northern woke people. That's just like a fundamental thing that's happening in American politics. And you're exactly right. It's not like these people do not wake up thinking to themselves, like, what I really want today is Mitt Romney's economic policy. What they really like about the Republican Party is, frankly, the culture war stuff, right? And to the extent that Trump departed from Republican orthodoxy on a lot of economic issues, they love that too, right? The trade stuff people in my hometown absolutely love. I mean, I had a meeting just a couple of days ago at this wonderful company in my hometown that's still making, you know, steel. It's still making sort of products out of steel. It buys rolled steel from AK Steel, where my grandfather worked for 35 years, manufactures it into components for furnaces and other places. And it's what was so cool about it is you got maybe 150 people working at this factory. You know, I met with some of the folks at the factory. I met with, you know, the CEO and the owner of the company. And it's like all of them agree on a few core things, and the union, by the workforce is totally unionized, by the way. They all want like socially conservative outcomes. They all love their country. They all want a trade war with China, and they all love Donald Trump. And it was this interesting way where you have a very wealthy person who owns the place. You have a lot of workers who are like unionized working class people, but they agree on these core things. And that to me is the Trump base, right? Like traditional Republicans are mostly going to vote for him. I think some of the upper middle class folks are migrating to the Democrats. You know, the sort of the Northern woke Yankees are always going to hate the guy. But where I think the meat of the Republican Party is these days are, you know, absolutely the people that I grew up around who were Union Democrats 50, 60 years ago, but have really migrated right.
JD, a question I had to ask you. So going back to law school for one second, what was it called? FIP, F-I-P, I forget the name.
I think it was for Fall Interview Program. Interview with a lot of law firms. I'm amazed I remember that, actually.
Well, in Quebec, we call it the course au stage, which is the race to the internships. And it's in your first, second year. You send your CVs out, you go to these dinners at these big firms, medium firms, boutique firms. You rub elbows and it was an amazing thing where my experience was exactly what you described in the book, which is, you know, it's a question of going to these functions, showing the people that you can drink but not get drunk, that you are,
I said, that's right. Yeah.
No, they say, you know, they're watching you. You're not, if you don't drink, they're going to have questions. And if you get drunk, they won't have any more questions. And it was just a question of, you know, showing that you're sociable, that you'll be functional within this community. The question was this, though. Did it turn you off? Because, you know, I'm full disclosure, I'm youngest of five kids. You know, my parents have been married for 51 years. My dad's a lawyer, has been a lawyer for 40 some odd years, was a managing partner at the litigation firm where, you know, one of Canada's top firms. I knew what this environment was going to be like, and it still shocked me. I mean, how much of a shock does this come to you as? And was it not off-putting potentially to the point where you wanted to just go somewhere else?
Yeah, I mean, it's let me think how to answer this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that
without burning bridges.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think I understood instinctively that this was like a necessary thing that I had to deal with in order to achieve any sort of stability, right? And the like, I didn't like a lot of it. I mean, there were parts, you just, like, to be totally honest with you, there were definitely ways in which I started to like feel myself assimilating into that kind of broader culture. And, you know, if you sort of like one way of explaining my, like, you know, the easy way of explaining why didn't you love Trump in 2016? Why do you like him in 2020? It's like, well, you know, the policies were really good. That's, you know, okay, that's true. But the more like psychologically accurate way would maybe be to say that, like, I was feeling myself assimilating into that Borg. And then I kind of really wanted to stop that, right? I sort of realized that there is a way in which so much of this is like both a cultural and economic war of elites versus non-elites. And you start to, like, you know, like find yourself linked into a lot of these communities in a way that ultimately makes you kind of a class traitor, right? And so, I mean, you're absolutely right that there is sort of a dimension of like, well, I got to get the hell out of there. I think on the one hand, it's really hard to do when it's your only real link to a better life, right? I mean, like, I knew that if I finished this school program, I would get a lot of money, I'd get a nice job, I'd have stability in a way that was totally crazy to, you know, up to that point in my life, that, like, you know, I would be able to help my mom and my sister and all the people in my family pay for things. That sort of, I think, financial pressure does lead to the cultural pressure to assimilate. And that's, you know, it's funny when the most interesting conversations that I have with people are those from similar backgrounds, you know, whether they're black or white or, you know, come from the same geography as me, but come from like a working class background and find themselves in elite institutions. And the pretty consistent theme that I get is, how do you succeed in elite America? How do you get the material benefits of it without finding yourself totally sucked in to this really, really gross group of people? And, you know, my answer is always like, you've got to try as best you can to keep one foot in one door and one in the other. It's not easy. But anyway, that's sort of a long answer. I'm not sure I answered your question, but
no, it's good enough. Now, I want to bring this chat up just because I think you'll be able to respond to it. It's not a nice chat. And
please.
It gets us into the next realm of, which is going to be the political questions.
Yeah.
So this guy isn't tough enough for politics. He will get eaten alive by the Sherrod Brown losers of the world. maybe they don't know of your. I think anyone who's gone through 4 years of military training and service is strong enough for politics. People tend to think to succeed in politics, you have to be thick-skinned, but also just malicious. I'm not sure. The second part may be true. We'll find out. But there is discussion of your future in politics.
Yeah, you know, I mean. One, I try to maintain a sunny disposition, and I'm sure there are all kinds of ways in which I would be a totally terrible political candidate, but I'm not worried about being able to take a lot of crap, in part because of the book and the response to it. And there was this brief period, you know, where everyone like loved the book for like 2 or 3 weeks, and then people started to really hate the book and hate me because of it. Mm-hmm. I think that like all of the stuff that people tell you about politics when you're thinking about running for something, like the consistent thing I hear from folks I talk to about it is you have no idea how hard it is to just be, you know, criticized all the time, you know, have your words misinterpreted, misappropriated, totally taken out of context, lied about it and all that stuff. And it's like, yeah, I've kind of dealt with that for the past 4 years. Like, you just kind of suck that up and accept it. I mean, I think the part that I'm not good at, and, you know, whether I become a candidate, I am thinking very seriously about it. The part that I really hate is, like, I am sort of a Scots-Irish hillbilly at heart. And, you know, when people go after my family, there's like, you know, there's like the calm, sensible part of me that says, oh, you know, JD, this is part of the business and you've got to, you know, you've got to make your points and be rational and not worry about the trolls. And, you know, then there's like another part of me that says, yeah, I'd love to, like, you know, find this guy and do something, and, you know, do something with him. I'll keep it PG for now.
you want to keep it PG?
That part of it will be, I think, a little bit interesting. And then the other part of it is, you know, and it's funny because that instinct exists for my family too. So the most hilarious part about publishing this book, and I love it, is that every now and then some Yahoo will put something on Facebook or Twitter that's critical of me, and I'll get a phone call from like at two o'clock in the morning from like a cousin in southeastern Kentucky who got drunk and read it, and it's like, JD, we got to find this guy and kill him. And I think, like, in different ways, all of my family reacts to that stuff in a very powerful way. So I've just had to tell my sister, my mom, all my cousins, like, look, guys, they're going to come after me whether I run for something or not. You just kind of take it in stride and suck it up a little bit. But certainly I'm very good at taking crap. I think that what you have to do is just ignore it. Tucker Carlson once said that to me, that if you let your family read the comments on everything you do, then they're going to go crazy. That's probably true of yourself too. So just try to ignore the trolls, except you're getting a lot of crap, and get on with your life.
Well, I had to block one only for spamming reasons, because the trolls and the negative comments are one thing, but spamming over and over again is the only thing that, and threats that detract from a conversation. Sorry, Robert.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. Now though, I've had to tell my nephew, you know, no, you can't shoot him. Nope. It's still against the rule.
Right.
But natural instinct. But in that context of like dealing with, well, I got my own corporate law story. What was nice was when we're doing those little corporate shindigs, for those people who don't know, these corporate law firms, you're a young law student. If you want to get a gig there, you go and do these dinners, or you go to these interviews and all this jazz. I made the mistake of giving honest interviews, my first 8 interviews, because I told them why I left Yale. And they were like, oh, my God, we can't have this kid anywhere near us. Then I learned to change that story, modify it just enough. And then I got plenty of callbacks, almost ended up working for a Columbus firm. But I was only going to work for a summer. I was out of there quick. Then the second great story, though, was once they let everybody know, they had a dinner party, but they let everybody know who was going to actually get the invites, who was going to get job applications and who wasn't. So a bunch of us were like, oh, this is perfect. We get to go and crash this party. We're just going to get drunk and trashed. And so we went there and I got so toasted. It's unfortunate. I'm standing across from this guy who did get one of the job interviews. I mean, got one of the callbacks. And and for those who don't know, callbacks, when you go back for interviews at the firm, and that gives you your chance to win. So this guy's got to be on best behavior. I don't, because I'm getting toasted, because I know we're on the outs. So I was sitting there. I was so drinking, so heavy. I just accidentally tossed the whole beer right on his like shirt and tie. And he just acted like it didn't happen. He just stood there and kept talking to me politely because he had to stay nice with everybody. I was like, oh, okay. So, yeah, that was my callback experience. I'll never forget. It's what I interned for my second year for a big corporate firm in Chicago. I was only there so my little sister could go to college. And then she went and said, college sucks. But, you know, that was the goal. It did pay for tuition for a year or two. But the corporate law partner told me, she said, Robert, I think you'll be a great lawyer. Just not a great corporate lawyer. I was like, that's very true. No, there's no doubt about that. But in that context, what you describe is, particularly for those who have an opportunity to jump out of whatever their economic or social predicament may be, or society may be, is along the way, you get offered multiple opportunities to take the primrose path in one way, shape, or form, either shame, disassociate, disapprove of the people you come from and the place you come from. And the hard part is because the rational choice is often to take that. I mean, I remember when I was at Yale, we created a whole protest organization because they were going to try to get rid of need-blind admissions and need-based financial aid. So me and some poor kids created some trouble. He's a lefty old buddy of mine, but he created Poor at Yale, so called it Pay, was really good at distributing brochures. Another buddy of mine grew up homeless in the streets of New York City. Yep. Favorite thing to do is sit down at the cafeteria tables and just tell people, you know, what his life was like at 6 years old. And just to see their shock on their face, he kind of enjoyed it. He was old school that way. Italian, old school guy. But and led to that. But during that process, it was clear, like, once we had success, mostly because the editor-in-chief of the Yale Daily News, who's now an economics editor of the New York Times, put us on the front pages, and he made us look huge. So we weren't really that big. We had like 20 of us. But he knew that all the Yale deans, all the Yale administrators had no clue how Yale students actually thought, other than what was on the Yale Daily News front page. So he put us on the front page. I mean, we're this massive movement, massive resistance, all this jazz, which was fantastic. End up with a meeting with all 19 deans of all the different, because there's that many deans at Yale, of course, all the different, as a 19-year-old kid, I showed up late. That's another story. But the so he sat at the top of the table, too, like I had, like it was natural somehow. I don't know where I got all that from. But and then ultimately they changed it. But before they ever changed the policy, they tried co-option. So it was, hey, we'll create a committee. You can sit on the committee. You'll get a lot of notoriety. And I even sat down with an associate Yale dean who said, look, you take this path and sort of tone all this stuff down, and you're going to get into Yale Law School, and you're going to get to write your own ticket for the rest of your life. And I was like, that's not who I am. I remember even telling me, don't you want your own kids to benefit from these legacy admissions policies and so forth? And I said, no, it's the last thing I want. If I get successful, I don't want my kid to take some poor kid's place.
Yes.
That's all opposite of my whole point of being here. And so I end up leaving in protest to make the point. But it was, you're often forced with those choices again and again, and you're forced to do things that are risky. You're forced to do things. I mean, I had family members that are like, what are you doing? I did the same thing, of course, in law school because I can't help myself, but turned down the corporate law route, went the independent route. People are like, you're crazy. It ended up turning out good. But can you describe the difficulty of that? The constant, how do you protect your community and not put yourself in a high risk path at the same time, and the difficulty those choices pose?
Yeah. I mean, my story with this is, you know, a guy, I wouldn't even call him a buddy, it's sort of an acquaintance of mine who's a couple years older, wanted to start an organization at the law school. You know, there are all these affinity groups that, you know, Black Law Students Association, Latino Law Students, Asian Pacific Islander Law Students, sort of, you know, ideological affinity groups like, you know, the American Conservative Union, the FedSoc, and so forth.
You left out the Gay Whale Law Student Association.
Yeah, there's everything, right? There's some of these affinity groups that have like three members in them. And this guy, I guess, wanted to start a Southern and Appalachian Law Students Association. And he told me that he went to the dean and asked about that. And the dean told him, well, that's covered by the Federalist Society. And this kid was actually pretty left wing, right? He wasn't even a right winger. I was actually in FedSoc. That was never going to be really a fit for him. The way that I would put this, I mean, Robert, that I agree with everything that you said, is that there are real material benefits when you come from an upwardly mobile working class background to turning your back on the people who made you who you are, who gave you all these chances. And it's just a very, very real thing. And it's, you know, there are a lot of things about, you know, the book coming out, and I was like this totally naive kid, and I had all these like media interviews that I was doing. And it's like, you know, I look back on that now, I was like, God, I was so stupid. I was, you know, I wish I had said that better. I wish I had said this better. But, you know, the one thing that I am most proud about is that I never took the bait and said, well, you know why people are voting for Trump is because they're racist. And you remember how much pressure there was to do that. And I realized how much just material benefit, frankly, would come if I was just willing to say, what's driving the Trump phenomenon is racism. There was such a desire to have that. And that's, you know, that's eventually why I stopped going on the mainstream press, is that was like all it was about, is like, let's talk about what's wrong with these people who are voting for Trump. And it's just, I'm not playing that game. And, you know, I do think of this in, you know, I'm not a Marxist, but I do think of this in sort of class war type terms, because, you know, this is sort of a slightly academic point, but I think it's worth making. If you look at all these studies that show an identification between Trump voters and racism, what they're almost always measuring is the like statements that people agree with when it comes to racial issues of the day. Like, for example, if in response to the question, the question is something like that, or the statement is something like this, and they'll ask whether you agree with it or not. It's, you know, previous generations of Americans like the Italians and the Irish are able to get ahead in America. We should expect the same of new groups who come to America as well, right? Like, one, you ask Black Americans that question, and they overwhelmingly tend to agree with it. And two, you ask white Americans that question, they overwhelmingly tend to agree with it. But when they do, they're coded as having high racial resentment. And then they'll compare people who believe in those statements with their voting behavior, and then they'll draw the inference, well, clearly the most racist people are voting for Trump, therefore Trump's voters are racist. And if you think about like what's going on in the context of this debate, right? Like, I think about my community. I think about the 90,000 or so opioid overdose people in the country every year, which is disproportionately affecting working class whites. I think about the industrial and manufacturing decline that was foisted upon the country by very stupid trade policies over two or three decades. What that is about is telling my people to shut up and not object to ruling class mismanagement. They're just bad people, right? Because if you can tag them as bad people, either stupid or bigoted, you don't actually have to listen to their concerns. And that's what really this is all about, is whether it's the micro pressures that people like you and me face to sort of turn our backs on where we came from, or the macro pressure to treat people as quote unquote deplorable so you don't actually have to listen to their concerns. I really think that what's going on is our ruling classes mismanage the country and they don't want to have to face up to it and deal with the people who are very understandably frustrated with them.
Well, the idea from a totally outside perspective, the idea of calling Trump supporters racist when he had the largest increases with the Latino community, the Black community, it doesn't make any sense as a statement of fact. It's just factually incorrect. Yeah. Now, whether or not the most racist people in America supported Trump, I'm not convinced about that either. And I, knowing a little bit about history, I'm not convinced about that as a statement either. The idea is when you frame the debate, and I'm saying this, seeing this from Canada and as an outsider with no dog in the race and no skin in the game, when you frame it from a social discourse as one of starting from white privilege, and then when you have anyone like you coming out and not complaining and not racializing the debate, but rather just giving your own experience of a phenomenon that is affecting a certain demographic, which happens to be white America, you have people saying, how dare you complain? You've got the white privilege. And for you to complain is itself a sign of racism. So shut up and sit down, sort of thing. And I think there was one politician who said that almost verbatim. But the idea, I've seen it. It's par for the course. You want to delegitimize somebody, call them racist, because the power lies in the accusation, and then you can disregard them. And our prime minister in Canada does the same thing, and it's equally enraging.
If I could venture a guess, I think the single most quoted section of my entire book is towards the end. It's really a throwaway line, sort of thinking about the recent politics of the geography that I'm living in, where I say that most commentators, I'm butchering the exact quote, but most commentators blame racism for Appalachian perceptions of Barack Obama, when really it's his elitism, right? That's really what they hate. It's not the color of the guy's skin. It's the sort of cultural segregation and condescension. And that line has been criticized so many times, even from people who are positive about the book generally. They can't stand the idea that it's not race that's motivating things. And, you know, I increasingly think of this as just like this ridiculous pathology among our ruling class. And again, it's like if you're focused on race, you're not focused on your own failures as a ruling class. And they just can't stop thinking about it. They can't stop talking about it. And I'm just one of these people, like, I'm so sick of it. I'm just so sick of being told that everything is about race. I am fortunate to have grown up in an era in the country's history where it really just did not enter my mind that much unless it was foisted upon me. And I feel like now it's being foisted upon me all the time. It's just total BS. And this is, by the way, I mean, you know, my advice to anybody who's thinking about politics in any capacity is, like, you talk to people and, you know, the cameras aren't rolling and they feel like they can be honest and open with you. The thing that I hear most consistently from working class voters in the state of Ohio is, we're so sick of being called racist. I think they know that it's being used as a weapon against their concerns, and they recognize that it's BS, and they know that the people who are doing it don't have their best interests at heart. And it's a hidden, powerful frustration that exists in the population, the constant accusation of racism. It's just people are getting sick of it.
And it avoids sort of the real discussion of the real issues at a core level in terms of ruling class failure. Because what's interesting is, in looking at some of the thematic aspects of your book, similar to Charles Murray's Coming Apart, other books like that, what's interesting to me is when I was younger, I saw an interview with Oprah and Alice Walker, where she asked Alice Walker about the lack of black male heroes in her books. And she responded, well, there aren't any in real life, which I was like, whoa, that's a little harsh. But then I was like, okay, there's something culturally taking place that she's describing. The next time I experienced that was actually in Russia and Eastern Europe. I asked a Russian, what defines a Russian girl? What defines a good man in Russia? She said, doesn't drink, doesn't hit, has a job. That was literally it. I was like, man, I should move to Russia. This is going to be gold. But I mean, that was the dynamic of it. What was that level? I was like, whoa. And then I started studying it. And I noticed that in cultures that had serfdom, in cultures that had slavery, in other parts of Latin America and Africa as well, disproportionately compared to, say, the Cayman Islands, where slavery didn't long exist, similar original African roots, but you don't see anywhere near the same patterns of behavior. They're old fishing communities going back centuries. And I was like, what you were describing in the book, what Murray describes in Coming Apart, the common identity that I noticed, and it relates to how you define an American dream, to have a home and to have a wife and good kids. Yep. You're describing the male identity of being a provider and being a protector. And what slavery destroyed was the ability for men to play that role within the slave community. Mm. And the same way that serfdom did. And the same way often also with friends, I clerked for a Native American tribe when I was younger, as a younger lawyer, and I have a great Native American law professor that was fantastic. But he was describing the same thing in reservation communities particularly, and that it wasn't something that was long within his particular tribe. It was something that, and it was the same pattern. It was when men can no longer provide, can no longer protect, that it creates cultural phenomenon, attachment tendencies with parents and children that recreates after whatever it was that first started it. And I thought that's where going back to, as one aspect is jobs, another aspect is culture. One aspect is when you strip people of jobs, because demanufacturing happened to working class blacks in the urban north before it happened to working class whites. And we saw similar patterns of what it did to their communities. Black unemployment used to be less than white unemployment in 1960. But in the same dynamic we're seeing now across the entire sort of sociocultural landscape, and that one of the problems is demanufacturing and how that's played a big role. Also illegal immigration and the way that creates labor substitution issues.
Yep.
But the other is now it's been topped over the last decade or so for men. Like the biggest thing with Trump was men. It wasn't. It didn't matter whether they're white, whether Latino, whether African American. There was a lot of men who disproportionately supported Trump. He had the smallest racial disparity in 2020 between a Republican and Democrat in since the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I mean, it was that degree of shrinkage. Even Nixon didn't have that degree of small gap, and particularly amongst men. And now they get on top of that woke culture that says masculinity is bad. To be a man is bad. Toxic masculinity is bad. But if you're a white guy and you're a straight white guy, then you're the bottom of the bottom of the gutter somehow. And to what degree does that explain in part what you've identified and why it is you care about the issues that you do in terms of jobs and culture?
Yep. Very, very good question. And this is one of the weirdest, intellectual pathologies of the ruling class is that they're very uncomfortable acknowledging that men and women are different and they need different things. And I can remember being a 7-year-old kid and driving by a used car dealership and my grandfather beaming with pride and pointing out a car and saying, that car is made with Armco steel. It's incredibly powerful. And no, I'm not saying that feeling never exists in women, but I think that it is an important, critical part of successful, healthy male psychology to make things, to be able to provide for your family. And we have, you mentioned historical examples, but through deindustrialization, I think that we've taken that away from a lot of men. And, that really matters aside from the economic piece and aside from the psychological impact of those individual men, because it means you have an entire generation of young girls and young boys who are growing up without healthy fathers in the home. And that's a really powerful problem as well for different reasons, right? I think boys and girls both need dads around. I think they need them maybe for different reasons. We know, for example, that women who have healthy relationships with their fathers have much more successful marriages later in life. We know that boys who have healthy relationships with their dads do much better in the labor market later in life. Sort of all these complicated things going on. But one of the big, big problems that we just cannot talk about, I mean, this is an elite thing, right? You talk to elites about the problems in the workplace, about the problems in any place, and it's like they think the biggest issue in society is that in a McKinsey boardroom, sometimes a man talks over a woman, right? That is like their biggest concern is, I forget exactly, toxic masculinity, right, in the workplace. You have people who like spread their legs too wide in a subway station or too vocal at a board meeting. It's like the masculine problem that is most acute in the community that I grew up in is not enough dads and not enough homes. And that's a way bigger problem, I'm sorry to say, than a Goldman executive not being properly respected in the workplace. It just is. But again, this is something that our elites are very uncomfortable with because I don't know why it is. I think maybe it's an anti-religious thing. I don't know where it's coming from, but they hate the idea that men and women can actually be different and have different psychological needs.
Well, I mean, I always describe it as they're the people that are running the Titanic, and they don't want to change the class status of anybody on the Titanic. And the Titanic's still going to sink with the way they're doing the ship. But they just want to make sure that the top, that first class, has an equal number from each racial group, gender identity, sexual preference, well, whatever, you know, the alternative religious thing, whatever the newest identity wave is. But they're not changing the power on the ship, and they're not changing the steerage on the ship. And as long as that's the case, we're all going to sink in the end.
Yep.
But it's not really, these revolutionaries are pseudo-revolutionaries. They're not real in that sense, aside from the way that they cause meaningful cultural damage that flows down to working class communities in small towns.
That's right. That's right. So guys, I just got the 5% warning on my iPad, which gives me plenty of time, but just want to give you that warning maybe in 10 minutes or so. I don't know how much more.
And I have one topic that we need to get into. So from law, you went into what is it called? Venture capitalism.
That's right.
So you're heavily involved in tech and high-tech stuff. What are your feelings now on what you see going on YouTube, on Twitter, Facebook, censorship? What do you see as the problem? What do you see as a potential solution? And how do we get there? Big question.
Well, so there are two problems. You know, one is maybe a little bit more esoteric and one is a little bit more relevant. So I'll start with the esoteric because I think it's, you know, I've got the microphone, so I'm going to say it, and I think it really does matter. So problem number one is that our economy is actually not very innovative outside of digital technology. So you look at transportation, energy, maybe pharmaceuticals is an exception, but the real economy is actually not seeing that much technological development. So we have this society that feels like it's constantly changing, but what you really have is a lot of globalization, meaning a lot of shipping of manufacturing in the industrial base overseas to China, to Mexico in some cases, but you don't have nearly the same real technological innovation in sectors where most people live and work, where people are using their hands. And I think that's a major, major problem. It means our planet's getting dirtier. It's getting a little bit slower. It's not nearly as capable of handling, all the additional people that we have to feed. But we have seen a lot of innovation in the world of digital technology. And so what that has meant is that the digital world, I mean, look, we're talking on this incredible platform right now, has become much more powerful and much more ubiquitous in all of our lives. So I think that's the first problem is like fundamentally an economic problem. We need more productivity enhancements outside of just digital technology, or we're going to have a stagnant society. Again, that's a little esoteric, but I'm obsessed with it, so I thought I'd bring it up. Second thing is we have technology censorship in the world of digital technology of conservatives, of people of traditional American values. And again, because the digital technology world is so powerful and such a big part of our lives and how we communicate, it's completely taking over American democracy. People talk all the time, of course, about the 2020 election. Was it fair? Was it unfair? And the thing that I always point to people is, look, the biggest and most obvious unfairness in the 2020 election is that our big technology monopolists were actively censoring negative information about President Biden in the run-up to the election. Big stories that we know from research would have shifted the vote in big ways were totally censored. So you have a way in which big tech is actively influencing the functioning of our democracy. One of my favorite sayings is, if you can silence the king, you are the king. Of course, Facebook and Twitter silenced the sitting president of the United States, duly elected by the American people. If you can silence the king, they are the king. That's a really, really powerful problem. And I think, unfortunately, like, there's a way in which establishment republicanism or conservatism or whatever you want to call it is completely incapable of dealing with this problem because they're so terrified of using political power against quote unquote private companies. One, I think it's kind of bogus to call them private companies. They exist through special government privileges. You know, Section 230 is something that almost no other American industry can benefit from. And of course, the corporate form itself is a political act. We give corporations access to capital markets. We give corporations liability protection because we think they serve some national purpose. If they stop serving that national purpose, why are we giving them all these protections in the first place? The answer is we should stop doing that. And so, you know, what should we be doing about it? I mean, we can go into some detail on this if you guys want to. But, you know, I think there are a few things that we should be thinking about. You know, first, I'm a big fan of Josh Hawley's proposal. And underlying that proposal was, look, these companies have just gotten too big. We need to break them up. They've gotten too powerful. We need to limit their power. We need to make them smaller. That's an important piece of it. I think the second thing that we could do is actually use the existing civil rights bureaucracy against tech censorship of conservatives. And so we could say, in the same way that if you fire someone for being a man or being a woman, that if you fire someone or censor someone purely because they're a political conservative, you're not allowed to do that anymore. They can file a lawsuit against you in federal court, in state courts that prevent you from doing that. A third thing that we just need to do is, in my view, we just need to go after the entire business model of big tech. First of all, they're not actually that innovative and they're not that important. It's ridiculous how we have built this model in our mind, these technology companies, that they're the most important and most innovative parts of the American economy. Fundamentally, what Google, what Facebook, what Twitter do is they get you to stare at your cell phone and they sell you advertisements. Like, I'm sorry, I'm not that impressed with the underlying technology. I'm much more impressed with technology that allows us to cure cancer or things like that. Addicting people to cell phones so that you can sell them ads, give me a break that that's somehow super innovative. And so I think we should just go after the entire business model of these companies, go after the monopoly profits, go after the advertising model, make it hard to extract rents from addicting people to these technology devices. I'm sort of, you can probably tell, I'm trying to get all this out before my iPad dies. But my view is, like, we should have an all of the above proposal. I think that these companies are the biggest threats to American democracy that exist. And if we don't destroy them, we're going to lose our country. Let me just give you one other idea and one other thought on this. So my sister was telling me this a couple weeks ago, and I still am just so flabbergasted by it. So a friend of hers was a friend of hers posted something on his Facebook that was pro-Trump. Not bad in any way, just pro-Trump. He sort of offered a political opinion on Facebook, like a lot of people do on Facebook. The guy's probably 40 years old, middle-class guy, blue collar, has 5 kids, supports his family, is a good dude. And some of his Facebook friends, putting that in scare quotes, found out about his political post. They talked to their other friends about it, and they got like 10 or 11 people to call this guy's employer, middle-class guy in Middletown, Ohio, and try to get him fired. Okay, that's cyberbullying. By any other name, if anybody else did that, if a journalist did that, we would call it harassment. If you showed up at somebody's house and tried to get them fired for an op-ed that they published in the paper, we would call that harassment. If Facebook and Twitter, if they have the power to censor the president of the United States, they have the power to stop that kind of cyber gang from destroying a person's life. Luckily, this person did not lose his job because his employer actually had some backbone. But we should make the technology companies liable for this. If you are the medium by which we're bullying and harassing people, you should lose something. You should lose some money. You should lose some protections. And again, I think all of these things together should be on the table. And if we enact all of them and something else on top of it, we might actually have the capacity to rein in these companies. Now, one more point I'll make about this, just to step back a little bit, is I made this argument, I don't know, on Twitter a few weeks ago, and the tweet went kind of viral. I was criticized by Jonah Goldberg, who's sort of a establishment conservative writer. I see Robert nodding his head. And, you know, his criticism of me is that I'm like Bernie Sanders. That's a big scary thing to accuse somebody on the right of. Not that I want to accomplish the same vision of society as Bernie Sanders, but that I'm willing to use the same means to accomplish things as Bernie Sanders. And I think about this, in what other field of human conflict or disagreement would you go in saying, we're not going to use the same means as our enemies? Like, imagine fighting a war against people who have guns and saying, no, we don't want to use guns too. That would be inappropriate. Conservatives have got to start using the same means to fight our enemies, because the impulse that exists in the left right now is to totally usurp our society using their power. If we're not willing to push back using our power, then we're going to be totally screwed.
I mean, no doubt. I mean, it's very much, I call it the Marcus of Queensbury rules. There's a stylistic and substantive difference between the populist right and the establishment or the elite right. And one is, you know, they want to go in and fight like this. They're like the British who are marching along while we kept picking them off. And they're like, you can't do that. You're supposed to march in a line like us.
Yes.
You know, that's partially how we won the revolution. And the second part is substantive, in that this sort of libertarian, what I call it, corporatist down deep, because it's not always consistently libertarian, yep, from a philosophical perspective, of deferring to the private sector, of deferring to big business especially, is deeply troubling and problematic, whether we're talking about trade or we're talking about big tech. Because, yep, it's not only the censorship that you reference, it's also what you've also referenced that you were just talking about, is some of our greatest neuroscientists are spending their time studying ways to addict kids and mess up their minds, causing massive public harm. Where young girls, yes, have a rate of self-harm 4 to 5 times higher than the prior generation. I mean, this is, absolutely, real harm on real people, like the opioids. You know, you don't just get to, I mean, it's one place I agree with Michael Moore. He said if people really believed in, on the right, in free markets, they would let General Motors sell crack cocaine. I mean, at some point there have to be limits. And you recognize the sort of communitarian limits that Gary Willis talks about, Nixon agonistics, his long debate with Buckley, explaining how labor unions and the private sector can be conservative institutions, not like, yes, the governmental unions we have now, but old school private sector unions were actually fundamentally conservative. They weren't hardcore lefty, even if it was some mine workers, you know, blowing up some buildings now and then. So the that kind of history. But the other component that ties into all that thematically, in the personal history component, is the idea of inner loci of control. Like, what was amazing when I was studying what led working class kids to success, and the number one thing they found for upward mobility, the number one trait they needed, was to have an inner loci of control. A sense, in fact, I call it believing irrational things. You have to believe you're going to do things that the world around you says you, yep, really don't have a reason to believe that. Now, you mentioned that your grandma teaching you that. What else do you attribute your own sense of an inner loci of control to? That was it the culture? Was it personal experience? Family?
And JD, before you answer that, if you do go dead and we lose you, we're going to thank you in advance, but go for it as long as we can with the battery. And if it happens, Robert and I will wind up.
Yeah. No, of course. We've got a few percent here, so I think we're doing okay. So definitely my grandma and the example that she taught, getting me in front of other groups of people, finding me some other friends. You know, she always said, you need to, you know, find some better effing friends. That was a big part. Just, you know, exposure to a different social, a different set of social influences was really powerful for me. Then Marine Corps was another big part of it. I talked about being on the same team and learning that sense of willfulness. That's really, really powerful. And that was really, really helpful as well. I would say that, you know, in my, you know, I'm sort of only recently in the last 3 or 4 years gotten really serious about my faith. But certainly exposure to Christianity, right? One of the fundamental, I think, takeaways from Christianity is that we are all very much, we are all very much shaped by our circumstances, by the people around us, but we still have some responsibility to take care of ourselves, to act in a virtuous way. That sense that you could come from a disadvantaged background, but you could still, on the other hand, have some responsibility to yourself and your community around you. It was a very powerful Christian teaching. I just think there's a lot, and this is so complicated. But you know, I really credited just a lot of really good people in my life that came along at the right time, who showed me there was something possible, who gave me examples to emulate. I mean, there was a guy who lived next door to us. You know, he was a pastor in a church. My grandmother just thought he was the best man. She always said, you know, act like Sheldon. Sheldon is a good man. You should emulate Sheldon. Just little things like that that you pick up over time where things really worked. And I think that, you know, if I hadn't had, you know, maybe a few of those things, my life could have turned out totally differently, right? I mean, you know, there but the grace of God go I, and things really worked out for me. I do not feel like it's this incredible experience or story of individual achievement. I certainly worked hard, and I don't feel guilty for having worked hard, but I think the people around me deserve so much credit. I just, you know, a really lucky guy, and things worked out for me.
Well, I think you do a good job of balancing that sense of inner loci of control without the self-entitlement that comes with credentialed culture. Yep. And I think that's critical. I mean, I wanted people to understand that if they believe in themselves, a lot of things are possible that may seem irrational now. And I think that's a critical moral narrative that's been lost. And that often working class poor communities, I think, are deliberately taught that they have no control and no power. So they become more controllable by outside groups and other agendas, but which have these negative cultural and social effects. But at the same time, we can this sort of myth of the self-made man. That's the title of Gary Will's book on Nixon agonists, in the idea that we can do this without a community. We can do this without others. I'm here because I had a brother look after me, a sister look after me, mentors, teachers, tons of people. Just by the luck of the grace of God was I able to get to where I'm at. In another life, I'd be, you know, I might be a very effective criminal drug lord, but, you know, I mean, there was a lot of other paths I could easily gone down. That would have boom, boom, boom. It was all there. And I know I saw it in my father's life. Very smart, very caring, very good. The system beat him up every time they could. So it wasn't for lack of trying that he suffered the experience that he experienced. And I think it's important that people maintain that balance. And I thought one of the great legacies of Hillbilly Elegy is recognition of all the other people around us. And then what it really calls for is not only understanding your own inner loci of control, but looking out for the people that helped you get you to wherever you got and why that's important. So in that context, when do you think you might have a timetable to make a decision about running for public office?
Well, yeah, you know, something opened up. Senator Rob Portman from Ohio resigned or announced that he's going to retire in a couple years. So it's sort of this mad scramble for what will be an open primary on the Republican side. You know, I don't think I have all the time in the world. You know, I've been doing a lot of the work to figure out whether it's viable, whether it's possible, you know, what the advantages and disadvantages of a candidacy would be, you know, obviously the effect it would have on my family. I think I need to decide by, you know, late spring, early summer. I've probably got a couple of months, but not much longer than that. A lot of the things that I have to do, I can do even without being a declared candidate, you know, just sort of getting around, meeting people, talking to donors, talking to, you know, policy folks, like those sorts of things. But no, it's probably like I need to make a decision within, you know, a couple to a few months is my guess. But that's, yeah, that's sort of where my head is today. And if you ask me in a couple of weeks, maybe it'll be slightly different.
Robert,
please appreciate you getting it. You know, one of the things that always bothered me about the book is they, you know, people will say, well, it's purely a pull yourself up by your bootstrap story. And it's, you know, it's like, again, personal responsibility is very important. I don't think we can lose sight of it, but it's a lot about where you come from and the influences that are around you. Both of those things matter. And we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it's not either or.
One thing, JD, I mean, I loved about the book, and it's almost like a cliche, is that it described everyone with their foibles and their flaws in a loving and non-judgmental way, which I found to be unique. I don't know how it was actually done. Is that people's flaws are their flaws, but they also make them who they are in their goodness as well. And the other anecdote from the book, which is very much along the lines of Robert's question in your statement, the guy whose house is flooding, and a car comes and says, let me take you away from here. And the guy says, no, God's going to help me. And then it starts flooding, and someone in a boat comes by and says, let me take you away from your house. It's flooding. He says, don't worry, God's going to save me. Gets to the roof, helicopter comes, same story. The guy ultimately drowns, and he goes to heaven and says, God, why did you save me? And he says, I sent you a car, I sent you a boat, I sent you a helicopter. So that analogy, which is God, you know, God helps those who help themselves, is another great thing from the book, is good fortune, good family, and making the most of the opportunities that you're given.
Yep.
Based on the chat, JD, a lot of people want you to run for office. Run, JD, do it. We need you. The country needs you. You may not have enough battery power. This might be a big question. But in terms of the big tech breakup, I always say, what good does it do breaking it up? You're just going to have different shareholders with the same interests, and you're going to have the same collusion, much in the same way you already have the collusion between Twitter, Facebook, and Google. And then the second question was, darn it, I forget the second issue, but like breaking it up only goes so far.
So it's a fair critique. And the related critique is that a lot of these business models run on network effects, right? So there's an argument that even if you broke them up, they immediately reconsolidate. So it's definitely a fair concern. But I will say that some diversity of platforms within the broader media ecosystem is still valuable. We, of course, had Parler that got basically destroyed and is now, you know, kind of coming back on the App Store and on other platforms. You know, Gab, which was destroyed for a while, is, you know, sort of trying to build itself back entirely independently. My understanding is they've had some success. I think that when you have just more platforms where you don't have so many, you don't have like a three or four ubiquitous, hyper powerful companies, then you just increase the odds that some of these platforms see a business use, see a business justification for not going with the woke mob. And so I don't think that it's a panacea. I think you have to do all these other things as well. But I do think having, you know, a few more smaller companies that aren't as powerful increase the odds that you get somebody like a Rumble, for example, that is able to do things pretty successfully and pretty viably outside of sort of the big tech thought crime universe.
Oh, and by the way, I should say we're live streaming on Rumble, and apparently we have 4,000 people watching on Rumble because they have the new system. I remember the second thing was, how do you expect to have government intervention when the big tech censorship is greatly favoring the powers that are already in power, and you basically have a sort of a fascist unity? How do you expect to ever get any government intervention when the government in power is benefiting too much from this?
I mean, it's a fair question, and I think it goes right to the heart of what we're up against. I will say, we live in a very stark time, we meaning those of us on the political right. I always, you know, put my entire life of observing American politics has been that the right controls the business institutions, the left controls the cultural institutions, the media, the academy, and so forth, and we fight over the political institutions. We now find ourselves in a situation where the left has both the business and the cultural institutions. So our only hope is the people. And I do think the people are actually with us. But if we can't win in the constitutional republic and the democratic rules that it's set for our republic, then we're probably just screwed. So we might as well fight as hard as we can on that arena. And I think we've got a good chance of winning.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, it's a rational belief and justifiable objectives that are the only thing that changes the world. So why not?
Yep, that's right.
All right. And with that, I want to say our proper goodbyes when you still have some battery power. So JD, thank you tremendously for doing this. Fascinating, amazing book. And I don't just say that. I mean, I was actually in tears in my car at certain portions, and I burnt through it in a day. So everyone should read it. Hillbilly Elegy, if you haven't, and it's on Audible. So that's good for the lazy person. Everyone in the chat, thank you for the support. Thank you for tuning in. Robert, JD, stick around. We'll say our proper goodbyes. Everyone else, have a great evening.